Welcome back, everyone, to our afternoon session for the June 2023 Kriya Yoga Solstice Retreat on Friday. Today, 2 p.m., we have a special guest, Pascal Chambers. She's a meditation teacher and a yoga teacher for the past 17 years. She began studying with Roy Jean Davis in 2017 and then began teaching Kriya Yoga. She met Roy in 2015, began studying in 2017, and if I got this wrong, you can correct me in a minute. She's a certified Hatha Yoga instructor and ordained minister. So Pascal, today she will be talking about self-mastery on the Kriya Yoga path. So thank you for being with us, Pascal. It's great to see you.
Thank you, Ryan.
And did I get all of your introduction correct, or did I get some of the dates?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. Perfect. Okay.
All right. Well, Pascal's going to take over from here. And those of you who have questions, feel free to type in the chat box. And Pascal, would you prefer to answer them as you go, or would you like to wait until the end to answer the questions?
Probably the end.
Okay. So put your questions in the chat box. Then when Pascal is concluded, we'll check out your questions. All right. It's all yours, Pascal.
Thank you, Ryan. Yep. Hello, everyone. Good to be here. And take this opportunity to share some of what I've learned over the last several years on my Kriya Yoga path. And I do want to take a moment to thank Ryan for putting this weekend together and bringing all of us Kriya Yogis together. It's I think it's great to do that on occasion and get together and have some community and fellowship with one another. So thank you, Ryan, for that. I thought I'd start out by telling you a little bit about myself. I started my journey with yoga and meditation in my late 20s. And then in my 30s, I became a Hatha yoga and meditation teacher. During this time and up until my 40s, I was in seeking mode, I would say. I had tried a lot of different types of meditations and had some very good teachers, some very sincere teachers, and was fortunate to find some good enlightenment teachings out there. And they all helped, but nothing really clicked for me until I met my guru, Roy Eugene Davis. And once I found him, I felt like I was home. I knew that this was the teaching for me. This was the path. So I proceeded to dive in. And when I met Roy, as Ryan said, it was in 2014. When I met Roy, he was already in his 80s. So I wasn't sure how much time I was going to have with him. You know, I was hoping for a long, long time, but you know, he's in his 80s. So I proceeded to, and I was fortunate that I was able to spend quite a bit of time with him. I was able to go up on retreat 4 or 5 weeks a year for about 5 years. And I delved deeply into this path. I only read his books as he suggested for the 2 years. And I really, you know, try to make the most of my time with him. Also during this time, I studied some with Ron Lindon, who worked for Roy at the time. And then after Roy's passing, Ron became the senior minister and I continued to get guidance from him. I did some volunteer work for him and then I ended up working for him during the pandemic. So I was very fortunate to have quite a bit of close contact with these two amazing teachers. So if I refer to Roy or Ron during my talk, you'll know who I'm talking about. And I suspect everyone here probably is familiar with Roy. So I did a podcast interview with Ryan about the first 5 years. So if you're interested in knowing a bit more about some of my time with Roy, then you're welcome to listen to that. So moving on to my topic today, I'll be talking with you about self-mastery on the Kriya Yoga path. And I thought it would be helpful to start out by discussing what we mean by the self. So sometimes it's referred to as the small self or the false self. And this would encompass the things we mistakenly identify as ourselves, such as our bodies, our minds, our personalities, and our ego. Then there's the self with a capital S, and this is what is referred to as our true self. The Bhagavad Gita describes it in this way. It says, the true self is never born, nor does it die at any time, nor having once come to be will it cease to be. The true self is unborn, permanent, and ageless. So when discussing self-mastery, I'm referring to the small self. and sharing some of the teachings of our gurus and also ways that I have found useful to remove the obstacles to us discovering our true self with a capital T. So, and I also think it's, I also want to point out when we refer to the Kriya Yoga path, this is more than a set of breathing practices or meditation techniques. It's much more encompassing than that. And I think of Kriya Yoga as a lifestyle, a way to live a more satisfying and fulfilling life. So Roy would always emphasize to us that a healthy and balanced lifestyle was as important as any of the techniques. So without this foundation, we run the risk of becoming unbalanced. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, he describes the three aspects of what constitutes Kriya Yoga, and they are austerity, self-study, and surrender to God. So in one of Ron's talks, he described this as kind of three legs on a table, kind of holding up the practice. So as we attend to these aspects, we are creating a foundation from which our spiritual practices can be built upon. So the first one I'll go ahead and talk about is austerity. And when I would hear the word austere, it would bring up kind of a negative reaction. I'd hear austere and I'd think of things like being kind of strict and plain and boring. But when I look at it from a yogic perspective, it has a different meaning to me. So as I was preparing for this talk, I referenced several different books about the sutras because I wanted to see how they described austerity. Roy described austerity as intensive self-discipline. And then he goes on to further tell us without discipline, mind and feeling nature cannot be regulated, and inner confusion as well as outer chaos will be the result. So being disciplined is an important part of our Kriya Yoga lifestyle because without it, progress on the path will be very slow or, you know, maybe non-existent at all. So then I kept looking at other books and then I came across this definition of it, which is my favorite. And this was in Ryan's book, An Essential Guide for Kriya Yoga Practice. And he tells us through austerity, the yogi learns to master one state of consciousness. So this is kind of what the essence of what my talk is going to be about. I believe in order to master the states of consciousness, we must have some level of clarity and balance in regard to both the body and the mind. So I'm going to talk about both of those a little bit. And first I'll talk about the body. So in order to pursue our interest, do the things we need to do and want to do in life, it's helpful to have a healthy and robust body. Right. And when I think of having a healthy, well-balanced body, I think of three things: eat, sleep, and exercise. Right. So eating, there's so much advice out there about eating right now, what to eat, what not to eat. It's pretty overwhelming. So I'm not going to get into a lot of details about that because I think everyone needs to figure it out for themselves, what works best for them. But I'm just going to touch on a few things that I think are pretty universal to everyone. So the first thing would be to try to eat an organic diet and eat fresh, whole foods, lots of fruits and vegetables. If you're able to grow your own vegetables, then that's a wonderful thing to do. We have, my husband and I, we have a large organic garden. We have vegetables and we have berry bushes and all kinds of different things, fig trees and things like that. And there's just no comparison to eating something that you've just picked out of your own garden and are cooking immediately. There's just a freshness and an energy to that. So if you're able to have some space and grow a garden, I would highly recommend that. And there's also something about understanding where your food is coming from, because before I grew my own vegetables, I had no idea the work that went into it. So I'd go to the store and I'd see the price of something and I'd say, well, that's crazy. Well, now I'm like, oh, that's too cheap. How can they even afford to do that? Because I understand everything that's gone into that, that process. So it's very eye-opening. We should ideally limit processed food and sugar as much as possible. And we drink plenty of water. We don't want to drink a lot while we're eating. And we can follow Ayurvedic guidelines for some of these items, but too much fluids when we're eating dilutes the stomach acid. So you don't want to do that. You just want to sip when you're eating, but then the rest of the day, drink plenty of water. We also want to be mindful when we're eating. So we don't want to eat in a stressful environment. We want to sit down. We want to focus on our food. Maybe have some nice music playing, watching, violent television or having stressful conversations with people while we're eating. That all affects our digestion. So we want to have a calming, quiet environment to eat in. And we want to focus on our food. We want to enjoy it and we want to taste it. And then we also want to have a good relationship with food. So we're not addicted or attached to things. We're just eating for that. We can enjoy our food. We can have pleasure from it, but we're not addicted to it. So, eating a good amount of food, not too much, not too little, is a good idea. So it's good to look at our eating habits and see where we can make some improvements, and also to avoid addictions and attachments to our food and drink. It is important because a lot of times, sometimes the food, the chemicals, the additives that they put in food, they affect our mental states, they affect our moods. So if we're really trying to be balanced, then we want to eat cleanly and pure food as well. So the next thing I'll touch on is sleeping. Sleeping is important, and we want to get the right amount of sleep for ourselves. So generally, for most adults, 7 to 8 hours is good. There's times when you need more than that. If you're going through a stressful situation or you're going through some hormonal changes, you may need more rest. You may need 10 to 12 hours of sleep, and that's fine. Roy would often tell people to get more rest. And these would be people, I'd see them on retreat, and I could tell you he probably would tell that too, because they'd be kind of running around and they'd be going out to dinner and they'd be doing all these things instead of just kind of staying at the retreat center and meditating and doing what they were supposed to do. So some of these people, he would tell them, you need to rest. He never told me that though, so I must be pretty good at resting. So quiet time and solitude as well is good for us. We need to have some time to go within and just be quiet. So back to sleep. Ideally, we go to bed before 10 p.m. and we awaken before 6 a.m. This puts us more conducive with the natural rhythms of the body and of nature. We want to sleep in a cool, quiet environment, calming and serene. And it's recommended that we don't do a lot of screen time before bedtime. So they say 2 hours before bed, you should be off your laptop, not watching television, because what happens is the mind, this interferes with the production of melatonin, which is the hormone that helps with sleep. So if you have to do these things, and they sell these blue light blocking glasses now that you can wear. I have them, but I have still noticed if I happen to be on the computer late, even with them on, it does seem to affect my sleep. So I'm not sure how well they work, but getting enough rest is important. And then the next thing I'll talk about is exercise. And when I think of exercise, I think we want to move, we want to be strong, and we want to be flexible. Those three things I think are the most important. And regular movement is very important to keep our energy moving. We want to keep things flowing in the body. So we want the blood to be moving, the lymphatic system, craniosacral, all of that, we want to keep it moving. We don't want blockages anywhere in the body. So movement, we can do walking, biking, swimming, Qigong, Tai Chi, energization exercises, all of those are great to keep things moving. And we also want to do some strength training. I think it's interesting that Ryan talked about lifting weights in his talk earlier today, if you were on that talk. And so I'm talking about it as well. And I thought, how many times do you attend yoga seminars where they talk about weight training? And here we are twice in one day. So that's kind of interesting. But we do want to do some strength training. And it's important all the time, but especially as you get older, your bones can start to become weaker. And so it's important to do the resistance training or lift weights to keep the bones strong, keep the muscles strong. There was a when I would attend retreat, there was a story Roy would tell about when he was with Yogananda, when he was training with Yogananda. And he said, I guess there was weight benches or stuff and some weights for the monks to use to, you know, just to lift weights to stay strong. Roy said some of the monks would be really into their lifting their weights and how they looked and their muscles. And he said, you know, that's not what it's about. It's not about how you look. It's just, you don't want to stay healthy. And then he would also tell us about his own routine. And Roy, he would swim for his exercise. And then he would also, by his desk, he would have some dumbbells. And he would, you know, take a break from email or reading or whatever, or writing, whatever he's doing. And he would just, you know, he'd lift his weights and he'd do his thing. And he would say, I think the number was 2,000 pounds. He said, by the time I'm done, I've lifted 2,000 pounds. I've moved 2,000 pounds of weight around. So that was kind of interesting. And then last is stretching. We want to be flexible. So great way to have flexibility is yoga. And I taught yoga for many, many years. And one of the things I love about yoga is that you can actually hit all of these with yoga. So you can have a strengthening routine, you can have an energizing routine, and you can have a relaxation, you know, so you're hitting it all with yoga. So I definitely highly recommend Hatha Yoga to everyone. So just kind of touched high level on those things. Probably a lot of that was familiar to you, but, you know, sometimes it's good to have a reminder. And then I'm going to talk about the mind a little bit now. One of the things I think is really important with the mind is the ability to focus. There was an article that Ron wrote about this, and he said, one of the most useful skills to practice and master is that of focused attention. And then he went on to say, developed focused attention is the foundation of our tradition. So I've been observing recently, it seems to be, and I don't know if you've noticed this as well, seems to be more and more difficult to do this, to focus our attention. I feel like the amount of information that is coming at us all of the time, it's gotten pretty extreme. When I look at the internet now and I go to look something up, I was looking for a recipe one day and the recipe's like here, and then there's, you know, ads and this and that and banners, and I was so annoyed because I could barely find the recipe. And that seems like lately there's just been this influx of these websites with all of this stuff. So it's very difficult to focus on things. So when someone tells me now, go look it up on the internet, I'm like, no, I don't want to, you know, I'm going back to the old recipe books, you know, so that's something to consider, that we are having more and more information pushed on us. And there's more and more cases of ADHD out there in the world now, both in children and adults. And a key component of this disorder is difficulty concentrating and focusing, right? I read an article that said throughout the world, there are some 366 million adults that were diagnosed with this disorder. 366 million people have this. And I thought about that and I thought, well, yeah, of course, because we're not necessarily meant to process so much information all the time. So I think one thing you can do is you can try to limit some of that, limit the amount of information you're allowing into your awareness. Our meditation practice actually becomes more important than ever for us. We're training our minds to have a single point of focus, right? And our Kriya Yoga practice teaches us how to become more focused. So we almost, you can say, we develop laser focus on our mantra, on our breath, on whatever technique we're using, and we become free of distractions, and then the mind can become still. So this helps us at other times too, because we are training our minds to have this ability to focus. So I think it's interesting too, you can look at the flip side of this, that once you become aware of something, it's very hard not to notice it after that. Someone points out a sound to you that you hadn't noticed. Well, after that, no matter what you do, you can't not hear that sound, right? I was going somewhere with my husband, Rob, maybe about a month ago, and we happened to notice a Tesla go by, you know, the electric cars. We're like, oh, there goes a Tesla. It's kind of cool looking. And then, so throughout that journey that we were on, just a 30-minute drive somewhere, It's like, oh, there's another Tesla. Oh, there's another Tesla. And everywhere, you know, there's all these Teslas. So come to find out, you know, they lowered the price on Teslas. So I think there is more of them on the road. But ever since then, I can't not notice a Tesla anymore. Like everywhere I look, there's Teslas everywhere, right? So it's kind of interesting that when we hone, we have this ability to hone in on things and a great capacity to be able to focus. We just need to cultivate the skill some more. The next thing I want to touch on with the mind is our ability to choose our mental state. So Roy would do these guidelines for inspired living, and they were a weekly message. He would do a phone recording, and you could dial in and you could listen to it. And the last one he did, he said, choose to be happy. Happiness is not dependent on external conditions. It is your innate state of being to freely express. So we can pay attention, we can focus on our moods and feelings and see what is manifesting there. So if we're in a bad mood, we can try to identify why that is so. Oftentimes our moods are a result of our thoughts we are having. So if we're having a negative thought, this affects our mood and we can become anxious or angry about it. So if we want to put a stop to this, we can replace these thoughts with positive thoughts. And I have to admit, when I first would, you know, I'd heard about this kind of a bit of a new age, you know, thought process of, you know, change your thoughts, change your life. And I was a little bit skeptical about this, but Roy would teach this as well. And so I was more open to it. And then I realized that this is actually something that's recommended in the Yoga Sutras. So I'm going to read you a quote from the Yoga Sutras. It says, when the mind is disturbed by improper thoughts, constant pondering over the opposites is the remedy. That's from The Science of Yoga. And then the author goes on to say, as is well known, an undesirable mental habit can be changed only by replacing it by a mental habit of an exactly opposite kind. So hatred by love, dishonesty by uprightness. So if we find ourselves in this negative thought, this negative pattern, negative thoughts and worry, we can simply replace it. And now this is not always easy, right? Because there's a power to these thoughts. It's almost like a wheel gets going. And as the wheel is going faster and faster, it's difficult to kind of stop it once it gets going faster. So ideally you can catch it early on in the process and you can say to yourself, you know, you can stop yourself and you can say, oh no, I'm not going down that path again, right? Because oftentimes it's the same path over and over again, right? We need to shift this energy. I've also found it helpful if you're in the grip of this to do something with intention, and then the mental state will shift of its own accord. So, and sometimes you just need to distract yourself. If you're dwelling on something or you're worrying, you can simply go for a walk. You can watch a funny movie. You shift that energy and change what you're focusing on. So that wraps up the things I wanted to discuss under austerity. And I'm going to move on to the second aspect of Kriya Yoga, self-study. And self-study leads to the knowledge of the self. And Roy describes this as studious self-inquiry. And here we have some overlap with what we've been discussing about the mind. But now we delve even deeper in discovering who we really are. To really know ourselves, we need to do some serious introspection. So an important thing that we can look at is how we react to situations. So do we respond in an appropriate manner, or are we overreacting much of the time, or even underreacting? Are our actions based on the current situation, or are we dredging up all this stuff from the past? And much of this happens automatically and is out of our control, right? So we have these subconscious tendencies, these karmas, and they come up. And they're being triggered by things that happen around us. So when these subconscious tendencies arise, we can observe them instead of reacting to them. And then we are weakening the pattern, we're breaking the cycle of karma. So we can observe ourselves, we can be the observer. And I kind of view this as I'm kind of sitting behind my mind in a sense. And I'm kind of sitting back here. And I'm kind of watching what's going on in front here. I'm watching my thoughts. I'm watching my emotions as they come up. And I'm just simply observing them. And they're just kind of doing their thing. And I'm kind of watching them. So as we're doing this, we're seeking to maintain equanimity at all times, right? This is the way of yoga. We are the dispassionate observer of our thoughts and emotions. And this sounds very easy, but in actuality, it's very challenging to do this because oftentimes emotions come up and take us over and we lose our equanimity. We are no longer the dispassionate observer. We become the reaction. But if we're able to maintain our distance from the emotion and the reaction, then each time it happens, we are weakening its pull on us. And this process happens over a period of time. And sometimes you're sailing along for some time peacefully and nothing's getting churned up for you. And then someone comes along and just pushes that button and you feel yourself, you're going to erupt again. And oftentimes this is the people closest to you, right? They seem to be the best ones at being able to push your button. So when this happens, if you can catch it before it takes you over, at that point where you feel the energy rising and you just pause and you take a deep breath and just take a moment, you may find that you can regain your equanimity and become the observer again. So if we're able to do this, then we are not continuing these negative patterns in our lives. We're becoming free of them. So Yogananda tells us to maintain your equilibrium amidst trying circumstances. Stand unshaken by adverse turn of events. If you never lose your peace, you will find you're always victorious, no matter what the outcome of your problems. This is the way to conquer life. And so oftentimes the situations we are reacting to are with other people. So we really need to take a good look at our relationships. We need to study ourselves in relation to other people and how we react with them. So what are the majority of our relationships like? Are they healthy and respectful? Are we interacting with uplifting and joyful people? Or are we around a lot of negative and unhappy people? You know, are they complaining all the time about everything? Are they angry and bitter? Do we argue a lot with the people in our lives? So we need to take a look at this because it will drain us of our energy if we're not in these healthier relationships, and it will distract us from our higher purposes. And if we find that we are in unhealthy relationships and we cannot extract ourselves from them for whatever reason, then at the very least, we need to set some very strong boundaries. So we can limit our exposure to this type of energy. We can limit our interactions. And sometimes you just have to say no to somebody, you know? And you know, it doesn't mean you're mean or rude because nobody is benefiting from this type of behavior, this type of negative behavior. And if you allow yourself to be pulled into this, you are not only hurting yourself, but you're also perpetuating this behavior in the other person, right? So it doesn't make you a good person because you sit around and listen to people complain all the time, right? So we need to put the brakes on that. We can be there for people. And there are times when circumstances are very trying and heartbreaking, and talking to a friend or a family member about this can be very comforting. So we continue to support people, but we support them in the right ways. So it's imperative to our spiritual being that we do this, that we manage our relationships. We are kind, but also strong and firm about this. And ideally, we want to surround ourselves with optimistic, cheerful people. But also good, honest people with integrity as well. And so to attract these types of people into our lives, we need to be that way ourselves. So we incorporate the yamas and the niyamas, the five restraints and observances outlined in the Yoga Sutras to guide us on how to live a more spiritually based life. So as we're living in this way and practicing these higher values, then we begin to attract others who are doing the same. We actually draw these people to us. And as we do this and we meditate more, we begin to see the relationships around us change and grow. Another aspect of our relationships to consider is our attachment. So our attachments in yoga, we seek to rid ourselves of our attachments and our aversions. So we can look to our attachments and notice how they are not serving us. Right? Because if we are attached to things, then that can bring up fear. We fear losing the thing that we have become attached to. So if it's a person we are attached to and that fear comes up, then we become jealous and we may get possessive. Or if we live in a state of perpetual anxiety that something bad is going to happen to this person, we fear losing them. So, you know, this is not a good way to build a good, healthy relationship. We also fear losing other things, our possessions, our jobs, our money, our ego-based identity. If we have fame or a sense of importance, we fear losing that. All of these things are our attachment. And a big part of this is that we are seeking our fulfillment through our relationships. So the sense of oneness, this peace, this divine love of God that we are innately seek and crave, instead of going to the source for this, we try to find it everywhere else, right? So we try to find the fulfillment in our relationships and our jobs and our sense of identity, all of these different things. So this is a recipe for disaster because it can never be found in those places. Swami Sri Yukteswar said, "How quickly we weary of earth pleasures. Desires for material things is endless. Man is never satisfied completely and pursues one goal after another. Something else he seeks is the Lord, who alone can grant lasting joy." So we can love someone, we can be in loving relationships, we can have possessions and important positions that we hold, but we must always recognize the impermanence in these things. We appreciate the love that comes from others, but we don't need it. Our cup is full from the source, and anything else added to it becomes, you know, my cup runneth over. How nice, right? We appreciate it without becoming attached to it. So I'm going to tell you a little story about a little turtle named Pugsley. My husband and I have pet turtles. We have about 9 turtles, and they're kind of semi-aquatic turtles. And where I go to the gym, there's a park nearby with a lake. And I was walking one day and I almost stepped on the sidewalk. I almost stepped on a little turtle. He was like the size of my thumb, teeny tiny baby turtle. And he was about 30 feet away from the lake that he should have been going to. And I thought, he's probably not going to make it to the lake. So my first thought was to walk him over and put him in the lake. But then I got the idea that maybe we could head start him and get him bigger and then release him back into the lake and give him a better chance of surviving because he was so tiny. So I brought him home and that's what we did. My husband has a lot of experience raising turtles and taking care of them. And I knew when I took this turtle that I couldn't get attached to him because I was going to have to release him back into the lake because that's where he belonged. And so we had him for a whole year because we didn't want to release him in the winter when it was too cold for him. And we named him, which is a mistake. We named him. And I, you know, over the year got more and more attached to this little turtle because he was a great turtle. You know, he ate well, he got along with the other turtles. He got up on his little, you know, he sat in this light like he was supposed to. So when it came time to release him, I was resistant, you know, and I realized, shoot, I've gotten attached to this turtle. And then I realized that, you know, this is not the yogic way, right? We don't want to be attached. And so I, you know, it took me 3 weeks, but we took him to the lake and I let him go. We let him go. And I was like patting myself on the back for being a good yogi and not being too attached and releasing him. And then like a week later, I went to the gym and immediately, you know, drove off to go to the lake to look for Pugsley. And it was raining that day, so I didn't see any turtles at all. And then I go a few days later, it's sunny out. I go back again and I'm looking for Pugsley. And this time I see him, I find him. And I didn't think I'd ever see him again. So I saw him on this log and I was all excited. And I ran back to the car to get my phone and take pictures, send to my husband. And I'm all excited. And then I go back again, a few days later, and I'm looking for him again. And I brought food with me this time because now I need to feed my little turtle. And so I'm doing this 3 times and a couple of things dawned on me. One, I found it interesting that what you focus on, right, changes everything, right? Because in the past, I would walk around this lake and I may see a turtle here or there, and that's fine. But all of a sudden, I'm sitting there and I'm really looking for turtles. And like with the Teslas, there's turtles everywhere, you know, there's turtles all over the place. So that was very interesting to me. And then I also realized, oh, you're really still attached to this turtle. Like you've released him, but you have not released him. And you're still running back to see him and feed him and take care of him. You know, so not that there's something wrong with that per se, but, you know, I had the thought like, why am I not loving all the turtles in the lake, right? Why am I not feeding all the turtles in the lake? They're all the same. The only difference is this attachment that I have formed to this one little turtle. So I will still go back to the lake to see him, but I'm going to try to be a little more broad-minded in my thinking about all the turtles and love all the turtles the same, basically. So that's just my little example of attachment. So when you recognize this impermanence, then you start to live differently. And you're grateful every day for those wonderful people or things in your life, because at any moment they could be gone, right? So you live in a state of appreciation and gratitude for what you have in this moment. So just to summarize what we've been discussing so far, we've talked about two of the three aspects of Kriya Yoga. We've talked about austerity and self-study, and we've gone over how to optimally manage the body and the mind, some points about that. And we've talked about being the observer of the self, and we've talked about having positive relationships and letting go of attachment. So now the last part of my talk will be about the third aspect, surrender to God. So Roy tells us surrender to God is nothing more or less than letting go of the sense of separate existence. So we can practice this while we're meditating. We let go of our desires and our expectations, and we surrender to the meditation experience, whatever it is in that moment. And we're also not attached to previous meditative experiences that we've had, because that clinging, that attachment, actually prevents us from experiencing what we want to experience. So I had made this mistake. So a couple of years ago, I'd had this experience, and you can never describe these experiences to do them any justice, but I will just say I had a profound experience of oneness. And I was outside in nature, and it was this sense of nature, sense of oneness with nature. And it was so amazing that for like months, I just was like, I want to have that experience again. I want to have that experience again. And then, you know, I realized it's never going to happen again. It's never going to be the same again. So just don't worry about it and just do your thing. And then I remembered this quote I'm going to read to you from Autobiography of a Yogi, where Swami Sri Yukteswar is describing to Yogananda. He's describing what I'm talking about to Yogananda. And he said, every new joy is God. He is inexhaustible. As you continue your meditations during the years, he will beguile you with an infinite ingenuity. Devotees like yourself who have found the way to God never dream of exchanging him for any other happiness. He is seductive beyond thought of competition. So we can let go of our attachments and our expectations as we do our techniques. So our techniques, these are our tools that we use to help quiet our mind. When I teach meditation, I tell the students, it's like you have a toolbox, right? And as you're doing your meditation, you pull out your tools as you need them. And one of the things I always really loved about Kriya Yoga and the way we teach it through this lineage is we have a lot of different techniques we can use. So you may have a regular routine, but if sometimes it's not working, you can pull out one of these other techniques to use to help get the mind to settle. So we have our toolbox, I call it. And when we're calm and we're settled, then we put the toolbox aside, right? And we simply allow the meditative experience to unfold as it will. And this is why Roy would always start meditations with the statement, we open our minds and being to the infinite. We open, right? We allow this to happen. In his book, The Art of Meditation, Joel Goldsmith describes this process. He says, satisfactory meditation requires a letting go of personal selfhood. With its egotistic claim to possessing a wisdom of its own, in order that the power which we call the Father within can take over. So we have to set aside the part of us that thinks it knows what the experience is supposed to be, because we don't know, right? And each time I experience a new aspect of pure consciousness, I always think, I had no idea it was going to be like that. And when you think about it, you wouldn't want it to be the same every time, right? It would kind of become boring, right? So even the most blissful, wonderful experience, if you have it over and over again, it would just become the same. So there's always something else to discover, right? We're having these new levels of awareness. We're seeing things with more clarity, and we're experiencing the divine. So we do this during meditation, but we can also live our lives this way. And Roy tells us the solution to the problem of lack of spiritual awareness, and often its painful consequences, is to turn our attention to the source of all that is, clearly apprehend it, and wisely live from that realization. This should not be thought of as being difficult to do, because at the innermost level of our being, we are already one with that. So to me, surrender to God is about having our lives be divinely inspired and guided. It's a surrendering of the ego to this higher power. So our egoic desires become secondary to God's will. And as we gain mastery of the self, instead of the mind and our egos running our lives, we begin to follow our intuition more. And as we begin to listen to that inner voice and follow where it guides us, and if we can operate from this place of oneness all of the time, we want to also keep in mind that our intuition, our inner voice, speaks softly to us. So if there's too many distractions, too much noise, then we cannot tune into that, which is the source of everything. So we're actually cutting ourselves off from the very thing we seek the most. When I would go on retreats with Roy, Roy would always guide us to be quiet, to not talk too much. He said, you know, okay, a little bit of socializing, but he wanted us mostly to turn within and do our work. And there was two different, there was two different types of retreats. There was public and private retreats, and the public retreats were much busier. And so there'd sometimes be 60 people on retreat, and we'd be having, you know, we'd have meals together, and it could get pretty loud and talking and having a good old time. And I remember one retreat we were on, I guess we were especially social, and we got in trouble. And they put out little signs on the tables at lunch saying, be quiet, don't talk. And I got it. I understood at the time somewhat, but I wish I understood then how I understand now, right? Because I was enjoying me, you know, seeing all my friends from around the world and visiting and stuff. But I realize now that all of that was a distraction for me. And all of that caused my mind to be busier. And, you know, at times took away from my ability to gain what I could have from that experience, right? Of having this enlightened master that I'm meditating with and I'm doing all these things. But I was finding it more important sometimes to chit chat, you know? So quiet is important, right? Because quiet is when we can tune into that intuition, into that deeper sense of ourselves. So, and if we are a part of everything, we are not separate. When we truly realize this, we can begin to live in harmony with this divine expression. So as it is expressing, we can live our life in service to this greater process. And in doing so, we can find a joy and a sense of peace that most people don't even realize is possible. So every moment of every day, we can surrender to God. We can weave the thread of God into the tapestry of our lives, and we can live a creative, peaceful, and joyful life. So that is my talk. Ryan said there may be some questions.
Yeah. So we've got a few questions here. And let's see. The first question I see. Well, I see one question because I think I closed my screen. So if there are other questions, please type them in the chat box while Pascal answers this one. So the one I have here is, does attachment occur because of the relationship we have with the person, pet, or otherwise? So I suppose, does it occur because of the relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we've become familiar with this person or thing, right? We know them, and, you know, things that are in our life become important to us. I mean, this is a natural thing, but I think it's important, as, you know, we understand at the core of our being that everything is impermanent, right? So I live in an awareness that at any moment, the things most important to me could disappear, right? And it's learning to be okay with that. learning to understand that, you know, we're all one and it's all impermanent. So it doesn't really matter in a sense. And, you know, something I discovered over the years, as far as relationships go, is I've had amazing people in my life, but, you know, they've come and they've gone sometimes, you know, people move or things change. And, you know, so, and when I was younger, I would be kind of sad about that. But now I'm like, well, you know, that's okay, because it gives the opportunity for something new to come in, to come into my life. You know, it creates some space. And so I'm able to, you know, love more people that way. Right.
And there are two questions that were sent to me. It looks like it was just sent to me directly. The first question is, I do not always get along with my Kriya Yoga teacher, but I can't find anyone else. What should I do?
Is that you, Ryan? No,
maybe.
That's funny. Well, just you have several very good Kriya Yoga teachers presenting this weekend, so you may want to consider one of them. It's an interesting question, because you don't necessarily have to agree with everything your teacher says or believe everything your teacher says, but if you feel that they are living an authentic lifestyle and they're able to guide you in an appropriate manner, you know, there may be some personality conflicts there that come up, and I think that's okay. But it's just, have you found a true teacher is what I would be more concerned about. There were times, you know, I'd hear stories about where people would have disagreements with Roy and people would get upset with Roy. And sometimes they leave and come back again. And, you know, so it's not that we're going to always get along perfectly with our teachers, but are they providing value to us? Are they helping us along our path? I think is what's the most important thing.
Good. And so I'm asking these questions, and just those of you who are sending questions, I don't know what's going on in my chat, but sometimes they're disappearing and I've never seen that happen before. So we'll go through all the ones I have here. And if I don't get to it, put it in there again, because I'm not sure.
I guess I can see them too, Ryan.
And can you see them? Like the last, can you see the one? So can you see that one where it says, can you please clarify the yogic?
Yes.
And then there's like two more under it. Do you see any others than just two more underneath of it?
I see Yogi.
Yep, that's there.
I see, what was your relationship with Mr. Davis like?
Okay.
That one. Okay, so I'll go on to, what was your relationship with Mr. Davis like? Was there an emotional attachment to him, and did you expect him to have the answer to your problems? Were there unrealistic expectations of Roy that you had, and how did you overcome them? Yeah, those are really good questions. My relationship with him, you know, he was my guru, and I would make a point. My first time there, I was told by one of the ministers that you could ask for a meeting with Roy. And I was like, great, you know, so right away I did that. And just a side note, I would meet people that would not meet with Roy when they had the opportunity. And I asked one of them why, and they said, oh, I'm not worthy of it. And I was really shocked by this, you know, because I thought, gosh, that's really sad that you feel that way, you know, because here he is available to everyone, you know, and such a loving, non-judgmental soul. So I would always encourage people to meet with him. But anyway, so I would meet with him every time, and I would have an interaction with him. And initially, yes, I was under the misconception that because he was this master, that he should be able to fix all my problems for me. And if I, you know, I would tell him a problem and he'd be able to fix it. And it didn't work like that. You know, he would be very clear and say, not to me, but just in general, you know, I'm not a therapist. And I think that's one of the things that Ryan has mentioned in some of his talks. I've heard him say that sometimes you do need to go to counseling to address some of these things. So I didn't understand that at the time. And so I was seeking some things that he did not provide. But then eventually I realized that's okay. That's not his job, so to speak, right? So he provided the inspiration on my yogic path and the guidelines and the education that I needed to do these things on myself. And a lot of times to work through these things myself. Looking back at the question. So an emotional attachment to him. Yes, because at the time, he was the first person that I truly felt would never let me down. And I had never felt that way about anybody else, any other human being. And so that gave me a sense of safety because I had this person on earth incarnated who would always be there for me. Roy was not going to let me down. So when he passed, when he left his body, there was a strong, there was a bit of a panic to, wow, I just lost, you know, this only person that I've ever truly trusted. Fortunately for me, I developed a relationship, as I mentioned before, with Ron Lindon, and he, you know, he filled that role for me to some degree as well. 2 years ago, Ron passed. And then at that point, I said, I need to let go of all attachments to any teacher, to anyone. I need to go within and find these answers for myself to sort of come to that realization. But it was kind of a process, you know, over time. So I think I'm just reading the rest of these questions. So I think I answered that one. So another question, sometimes I have troubles with repetitive thoughts, especially when something I do not like happens. I always try all possible and impossible ways to release them and move on. When I try to replace them, there is a growing feeling of lying to myself, which feels even more uncomfortable. Can you, Pascal, please comment on that? How to let go of any unwanted thoughts as fast as possible? Any tricks? Yeah, and, you know, so as I mentioned in my talk, sometimes the thoughts take on a life of their own. There's a power to them. So sometimes it is difficult to change thoughts if they're really embedded in there. If you try, you can replace the thought. I'm trying to think of an example. Okay, so let's say as I was preparing to do something that I didn't really want to do, and the thought going through my head was, I don't want to do this. 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 What I could do is I could replace the thought with something like, wow, this is a wonderful opportunity that I get to do this. I could just change the way I'm viewing something, right? Oftentimes, Ron Lindon would talk about how our brains go into default mode, that the default mode of our minds is a negative, unfortunately. And so we can shift that and we can just change thoughts. We can literally start thinking something else, right? And I guess to your point that it feels like you're lying to yourself, it's like you have to come up with the replacement that feels right to you. And it's funny because I was talking to my husband last night about some concern that had come up for me. We're dealing with aging parents right now. And I said, well, this is bringing up certain things for me that it's bringing up fears for me about the future and different things. And he gave me a replacement. I said, I want to think of something different. And he gave me a replacement thought that didn't resonate with me. And I was like, no, that's not going to work. You know, that's not going to work for me. And I had to come up with my own. And so I think you have a very good point that you can't lie to yourself, right? You know yourself. So you have to find the new thought that works for you. And as I mentioned in my talk, sometimes you just have to change your scenery. Like, you know, if you're really stuck in a pattern of something, go out, go for a walk, do something different. Sometimes just watching some light television just to shift the thinking is helpful. So I think that's all I can think of to say to that one.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Well, it looks like that's the last of the questions that we have for today. So thank you for being here with us, Pascal. It's great to see you.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And I'll be back tomorrow evening leading meditation. And thank you again so much, Ryan. Really appreciate you.